The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
There's certain moments that just, they kind of hang in time, you know? They stick in your mind. And I'll give you a good example. I guess this is another story some of you may have heard, but that's okay. I relive it in my nightmares on occasion. When I was in basic training, okay, we had this sadistic little sergeant. That's a good way of describing him, whose name was Itzik. And he was for me the personification of hell on earth. You know, he was this short, wiry guy with endless stamina, right? And when he liked to make his point, right, he would get, like, right up in your face. Like, he wouldn't yell at you. He wouldn't talk to you. He would, like come, like nose to nose, you know? Friedman! Ismaya! Right? And sometimes you would just want to laugh because, like, you know, I'm 20 years old. I'm an adult. And this 19-year-old annoyance is, like, in my face yelling at me because there's dust on my boot. But if you laughed, you would meet, right? So you know, so anyway, about, I don't know, a week or two into the army, we went on our first forced march, okay? And I had never done this before, and we didn't know what to expect. We had heard legends of the horrors of, you know, Masaot, first marches in the army, and then we didn't know what to expect. Now, in retrospect, it was probably the easiest Masaot we ever did, because it was only like, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 something kilometers, right? And it only took about, I don't know, 2.5 hours, something like that. But, you know, we didn't know that, right? We didn't know when we were going to begin, when we were going to end, what was waiting for us. And they had already shown us that, you know, whatever we thought was bad could get worse. So we were very nervous. Everybody had to carry a bakal. Okay, you had to carry your thing. One guy had a stretcher. One guy had the M203 grenade launcher. One guy took the grenade. One guy took the ammo for the grenade, right? I happened to end up with a jerry can. Okay? It was like a 20-liter thing full of water, right? You had to, like, you know, strap it in this harness, whatever, tie it up with ropes, and it was a whole thing. You put it on your back, okay? And I was actually all excited when I got this. I thought I was being clever, right? Because I figured, you go on a forced march, people have to drink, right? So what's going to happen when they drink? They're going to empty out your jerry can. So it's all going to get light. Idiot that I am. No, you don't drink from the jerry can. It's just there for emergencies, right? Very dumb move. I also did not know that that you could switch. In other words, like when you start the army, you don't know all the little nuances of how to get by. And they don't want to tell you them because that would be intelligent. And so they let you learn it the hard way. So really what you do is you're supposed to take this on your back and you run with it. And when you start to get a little tired, you know, whatever, because you're not supposed to talk, whatever. And somebody switches you. And that way you're never really carrying it for more than 5 minutes, so you never get wiped out, and that's better in the long run for the whole unit. But at the beginning, you don't know that. So if you happen to be carrying the jerry can, you're stuck with the jerry can for a few hours. Carrying this thing on your back for a few hours is just unbelievably heavy after a while. And insult to injury is that we're doing this muscle on sand dunes. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried to run on a sand dune, especially when you're going up a sand dune, but for every 2 steps forward, you take a step back. So it's like something out of a cartoon, you know, you're not like, you know, right? And I remember the only good thing, at least, was that we had an inside informant. There was a pkida, she was sort of like the mail clerk, and she liked, you know, the unit, whatever, she was trying to help the guys. Of course, we didn't know back then this was all part of the system, and she was in it with the sergeants. We didn't know that. She's like feeding us this information, and she told us not to worry because she said, you know, look and see if Nitzan, if the platoon commander goes. Because if there's an officer, they can take you off to hell and back. But if it's only a sergeant, there's like regulations that you're not allowed to go out of sight of the base if there's no officer present. So we get there, and we're all loaded up. We're putting our stuff on, and we're all really nervous, and there's this like sinking feeling in your gut because you don't know what they're going to do to you. And then we see like Nitzan isn't there. The platoon commander isn't there. So I'm like, oh, this is great, right? Because they can only run us so far because, you know, we can see around the base. So we start, you know, running and walking and running and walking, whatever it is. And I remember I have a very good friend. We're still very close. We ended up in the same tank. He was my gunner. I was his driver. And his name is Pinny. And he actually also went into the army with almost no Hebrew. You can imagine being in a tank where you know, two of the crew members don't speak Hebrew, and one of them is named Pinny, one of them is named Binny. And create all sorts of problems, but that's for another time. But anyway, so he also happened to end up with a jerry can, because we were talking to each other when we got the bakalim, and they were next to each other. And I remember at one point, we're running around the base, like, they started to run us around the base, because we have to be inside of the base. Okay? And we get to this one point where there's this sand dune, it's like a wall. Okay? It's just this unbelievable thing, it's just there, right? And you're kind of thinking, why do you have to climb it? No, you really don't have to climb it, but they're making you climb it anyway. And we're struggling to get to the top of this thing, and this jerry can is threatening to pull you back, and we're trying to push each other and pull each other. And we finally get to the top of the sand dune. I'm like, I'm going to make it, you know. And we get up to the top of the sand dune, and there before us is this endless sea of sand dunes, right? And I still remember Penny's face. There's this look of pure horror, like the realization that we could be at home in America with a beer, and instead we're like running up and down sand dunes for some sadistic little, you know, mental deficient, right, individual. We used to call him behind his back the, you know, defect. He was like a defect of nature, you know. And finally we succeed and we get all the way around this base. We're up and down the sand dunes, right? And we're getting close to the gate. Like we've come all the way around, right? And we're sweating and we're dying and whatever, and we're close to the gate, and all of a sudden Itzik says, "Nu tarutsu, start to run," right? And we had to open up stretchers, and you know, he looks around the thing, right? And he picks the heaviest guy in the unit to get up on the stretcher, and we're all like dying, whatever, right? And then he says, "Nu tashiru," right? Start to sing. And it was clearly implicit in his voice that if we didn't sing a good song, then he was gonna, you know, I don't know what, right? So we start singing. Some guy, I was actually with Hezdernikim, with guys who I was with in the yeshiva for the first 6 months in the army. And one of them starts to sing a song from Shabbat, right? You know? Yom Zeh Mechubad Mikol Yom. And he starts to sing. So all the guys start singing this, and I wanted to kill this guy. Like, are you out of your mind, all those words? Do a 9-9, whatever, fine, right? And we're getting up to the gate, and I'm like, you know what? We made it. We made our first Masai, and start to feel good. Like, you know, we're the unit coming back from a Masai, you know, whatever. Of course, everybody else is looking at us like raw meat, you know. But okay, right? And we come in, and then come those two horrible words, the two most horrible words I think I've ever heard. Okay, just we're about to get into the gate, he goes, "Yamina pnei, turn right," and we turn out of the gate, and we have to do the whole thing again, and the feeling, this sinking, sick feeling, because you suddenly realize, like, it's true, he can't take you out of sight of the base, but a circle has no end, you know? And all of a sudden you realize you're at the mercy of this fellow. And that's the problem. The problem is, you know, sometimes it feels like we're just running up and down sand dunes. And you feel like you run up one sand dune, and you get to the top, and there's just another one, you know? And you feel like you take a step forward, and life just pulls you back. And sometimes you feel like you accomplish something, you get there, and then you realize it was for nothing. And how do you deal with that? How do you succeed in making sense of all these endless sand dunes? And how do you create a recipe for turning those experiences into something meaningful? Okay? That's really the question. And the truth is that there is an interesting ritual, okay? Because this morning, yesterday, we spoke about Pesach. But Pesach is basically an entree. It's a beginning, right? And the end of Pesach is not the end of the story. It's really the end of the beginning of the story, right? You remember Winston Churchill's famous line after the Battle of Britain when the British Air Force sort of pushed back the Luftwaffe invaders. He said, "This isn't the end. This isn't the beginning of the end. But this is at least the end of the beginning," right? So you get to the end of Pesach, and you think maybe you've gotten to the end of the beginning, but you're not there yet, because now you're headed into the desert. And then starts a very strange ritual. Before you get to Shavuot, which is 7 weeks away, right, 49 days, really 50 days, okay, which in and of itself is an interesting question. I mean, if the Torah is so important, why are we getting the Torah 50 days after we leave Egypt? So you'll tell me, well, because that's how long it took to get to Mount Sinai. We'll talk about that. But if God wanted you to get the Torah at Mount Sinai for whatever the reason, you could have put Mount Sinai next to Egypt, right? I mean, because that's God, right? He gets to do what he wants, right? Why do you need 50 days? But putting that aside, we have a very strange ritual. And what we do is we call this the counting of the Omer. Okay, some of you have heard of this before, right? Every night, you know, you count another day in the Omer. Okay? How many people here, just out of curiosity, this year experienced this ritual? You counted the Omer. Okay, right? Did you ever stop to think about this? This is a very strange custom. One of the saddest things about this custom is that this has become such a routine that people do this every night, but they usually don't think about what they're doing. In fact, they become so focused on making sure. There are all these interesting halachot. For example, if you count the day before you're ready to count the day, like if you come over to me today and you say, well, what's tonight? And I say, oh, tonight's the 15th day of the Omer. Now I can't count the Omer tonight because I counted it today. So guys will pull these funny things like, well, yesterday was the 14th, right? You know, or if you're leading the services and you don't remember exactly what day it is, you say, what was yesterday? Yesterday was the 14th. Okay, got it. And we get so into this, what today, is it the 15th, is it the 16th? And if you're leading the service, you don't want to be embarrassed. We get so into this routine that we don't really stop to think about what it is we're trying to do. What is it that we're counting? What is the Omer? Well, what does that mean? So I want to do something similar to what we did this morning. Okay? I'm going to give you a sheet, okay? And we'll take a look at this minhag. Alright, at this custom, which comes right out of the Torah. And I'm going to give you maybe a little less time this morning, you know, 10, maybe 15 minutes, just to take a look at this, okay? This is the mitzvah of the counting of the Omer. Grab a chavruta, grab a partner, and let's take a look at this mitzvah. Because this mitzvah of counting the Omer, the first day of the Omer, it's the day after the first day of Pesach. It's really the beginning, it begins with Pesach, okay? And the second day of the Omer, and the last day of the Omer is the day before Shavuot. So this process is supposed to bring me from Pesach to Shavuot, from Passover to Shavuot. Shavuot being the festival when I got the Torah, when we got the Torah. Okay, so take a look at this, see what bothers you, rip it apart a little bit, and we'll come back together in like 10, 15 minutes. Got it? Any questions? Okay, you learn, I'll... Alright, let's see what you got. It's a strange little custom, this custom. Go ahead. What bothers you about this? Pardon? What is an Omer? Good. Okay, an Omer is actually a measurement. Okay? It's interesting. The English translation of Omer is Omer, right? Do you like that? Yeah. Pardon?
A unit of dry measure.
Pardon?
A unit of dry measure.
That's right. An Omer, there are different opinions. I'm not going to get into the details. Komets, Omer. Let's just say that it's an amount of something. It's an amount of what?
Barley.
It's an amount of barley. This is a very strange sacrifice. I want you to know, this is a very strange sacrifice. Because this morning, we were into a sacrifice of lamb. Now that's a sacrifice. Okay? Now we're offering barley. Okay? Barley is a very strange thing to offer to God. First of all, it's not just that it's not animal meat, that it's grain. It's actually the coarsest type of grain. This is basically animal food. So that's very strange. Why am I offering up whole barley, animal food, to God? You know? That's strange. Okay? Okay. What else is strange? What do I do with this barley? Anybody know? Yes?
Front? When the Kohen weighs it, like
right.
A sheaf of barley, and he weighs it, it's a little bag of barley.
A good question. Is it a bag of barley, a sheep, a bowl of barley? Right, it's a good question, okay? Right? It's basically, a komets is an amount which is generally measured in piles. And therefore the general opinion is, right, you've reaped it out of the field, okay? You've threshed it, you know, whatever you're doing, and you've got the barley grains. In other words, when you give animal food, you don't just take stalks out of the field. You separate, right? That's what threshing and winnowing is. It separates the kernel from the chaff. You're taking the kernels, the actual animal fodder, right? And you've got it in a bowl, right, let's say. Okay? And he's doing this weird thing. Now, if you walked into the Temple Mount, and you'd never seen this before, and you see some guy up by the altar, and he's like... So it looks a little weird, right? A little weird. By the way, what does that remind you of? Right? Okay, and that's a little weird too. We'll get to that on Sukkot. The lulav thing. Is anybody here, I just have to know this. Okay, this has nothing to do with the class. Did anybody here ever walk into the synagogue for the first time and see the four species waving thing and think that they were in the wrong time zone? Yeah, you had that experience, right? Right, did you notice that? Do you ever wonder why we don't say Manishtana? Like, why is this different on Sukkot? That's a little weird. We'll get to that too. Okay. So we got this barley grain thing going. They take this barley, this animal food. Oh Lord, I wish to offer you animal food which is inedible to me, but I thought maybe you'd like it. That's a little weird. But okay. Right? When do I do this? Pardon? The day after Shabbos. What is Shabbos?
Day after day of rest.
Okay, when is the day of rest? So if Pesach is on Tuesday that year, nope. You're ready for Sadducee school. We'll get to that in a second. Okay? We'll get to that in a second. This is the question that you don't know you just asked. Okay? But this is a very strange thing. There was historically a debate which took on enormous proportions with tremendous political significance. In the time of the Second Temple, there were a group of Jews called the Tzedukim. Theologically and existentially related to some degree to the Karaites, although separated by about, you know, 9 centuries, the Tzedukim, to make a complicated story a little more simple, believed in a literal translation of the Torah. Okay? In addition, by the way, they were much more immersed in Greek and later Roman culture, and that's a whole other discussion, but they believed in a literal translation of the Torah. Now, I've read about the Tzedukee philosophy, but I've never experienced it. However, the Karaites, who were their very close cousins to some degree, not familiarly, but just in terms of theology, that was actually a sect of Jews that was begun by a fellow named Anan ben David, and the first Karaite synagogue, according to most authorities, was right up the road here. In fact, if we get a chance, I'll be glad to take you there. It's an unbelievable thing. The 7th century, Anan ben David, okay, started this sect. Most of it started in Bavel, but it also started in Jerusalem. And it was basically a literal translation of the Torah. So, for example, if you go into a Karaite home, and conversely a Sadducee home, the Tzedukee home in the time of the temple, you would find that it was dark. Because it says in the Torah, right, Lo tivaru esh b'chol moshevotechem b'yom ha-Shabbat. You're not supposed to kindle fire in your homes on the Shabbat. Now, how do we understand that? That means you're not supposed to make a fire. Right? But if you light the fire before Shabbat, that's fine. But they understood it that you shouldn't have fire in your homes. Why? And by the way, you know, when I was younger, I used to think they were nuts. But then you start to realize, okay, they have a philosophy. People aren't idiots, right? So they have this whole philosophy that developed around this, which is that the light should emanate from the synagogue. And on Shabbat, we take a day to remember that the source of our light is the synagogue and blah, and you know, whatever. Right? Tzitzit. So I wear tzitzit. And they're supposed to be, you know, ritemo time. You're supposed to be reminded, you know, of who you are and what you do. And that's why they're on four corners. And interesting question why men wear tzitzit and women don't have to wear tzitzit, whatever it might be. But since the verse says, uri ritemo time, you shall see them, so they had a much different way of understanding tzitzit. You take your tzitzit, you take a garment with four corners, and you hang it up on your wall. And when you walk into the synagogue, there's a big tzitzis up on the wall. Right? So you can see it and everybody remembers it. Right? Etc., 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 etc. So they had a very literal understanding of this verse. Mimacharat Shabbat meant the day after Shabbat. So if Passover fell on Shabbat, on a Friday, like this year, right? No, when was Friday? It was Tuesday night this year. It doesn't matter, whatever. If Pesach was on a Wednesday, then the traditional Jews, the Prushim, the Pharisees, they would offer up the Omer on the Wednesday, on the day after Pesach. And the Sadducees would wait until Sunday, the day after Shabbat. Alright. So this became a huge debate. Because, you know, if you start to reinterpret Torah, then that risks everything, etc. And this debate took on enormous proportions. To the extent that, that if a person was a Tzedukee, there was a Kohen, a Kohen Gadol, a high priest who was a Tzedukee, he was pelted with a srogan, with citrus fruits, one Sukkot. You know, talk about how you get a guy, but alright. And this was a big debate. And of course the question is, well, why is this a big debate? It's a big debate because the verse is very unclear. On the day after Shabbat, well, that sounds to me like Sunday. Now we have a tradition, which is an unbroken tradition, supposedly all the way back to the time of Moshe, that in this particular instance, Mimacharat Shabbat means the day after Pesach. But that leads us to a very obvious question. Why doesn't it just say, you know, the day after Pesach? And by the way, why does it just say the date? You could have added the date. You could have said on the 16th day of Nisan, which is what it does everywhere else. Then we wouldn't have had this debate. It's almost as though this is meant to be somewhat obscure. So I want to understand that, right? What in fact is the essence of this idea? Okay? All right. What else? Any other questions?
One, what is waving? What does that signify?
Okay.
Why?
Okay. So there's three issues here. First of all, what's the waving? What is this waving? What am I doing? And there are different opinions as to how I wave. But let's assume for the moment, right, that I'm actually waving. In fact, there's one opinion that says that what we do with the four species is based on this waving, which is something that occurs in different offerings, in the mincha offering, right? What is that all about? Waving up, waving down, waving across, waving back. Why am I waving it? Right? One opinion, I'm waving it across the altar. What does that mean? Second of all, the waving is different from the counting. Okay, the waving is the sacrifice of the Omer itself, but then I start to count. Now let me ask you an interesting question. Right? Why am I counting? What do you think I'm counting? Shavuot, right? I'm counting towards Shavuot. Okay? I get out of Egypt, and I can't wait to get the Torah, so I'm counting the days. The only problem is, if that's true, it seems like I'm doing it backwards. Okay? You know, I had a soldier. He was an interesting piece of work. His name was Chaim Barrow. There are four different cycles of the Israeli draft. Okay? The best guys go in August. Okay? And that's because they just got out of high school and they're gung-ho to go in. Alright? And they have to go into the army the year after your 12th grade year. But, you know, the army can't handle everybody coming in at once. So there are different cycles, right? And the worst of the drafts is the May draft. Because the May draft are the kids who come from very difficult families, families where they have to help support their, you know, their mother because they don't have a dad, or all these types of stories, you know, or they're underprivileged. So therefore, they're allowed to wait almost a whole year and to go in May. All right? And these guys, at least when I was in the army, we used to call them Meinikim. Okay? Meinikim or Mau Mauim, because there was a certain type of guy. You know, if you were on the base and somebody set fire to the field just for the heck of it, that was probably a Meinik. You know, if there was a big fight in the kitchen and somebody, you know, pulled out a kitchen knife, probably a Meinik, right? Like, these guys were tough. Okay, they didn't wake up early in the morning and study Talmud, right? So when I became an officer, I got to this base and I was given a company and it was full of Meinikim. I had a lot of Meinikim. And there was one guy, his name was Chaim Bell, and my relationship with him began the first full day. Like, I got to the base in the afternoon and it's a whole sort of journey of discovery when you become an officer in the Israeli army. You know, the first thing that happened to me was that, you know, for the first time now I was going to be in officer's quarters. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to be in officer's quarters, right? You know, guys who get through officer school, it's a very tough breed and you have to go through a lot and you have to get selected and there are psychological exams. So I figured this is great. Now I'm going to be with a quality, you know, and all of a sudden you're not sleeping with like 20 guys in bunk beds. You know, you have your own bed and you get a little cupboard, you know, because you're an officer. And I walked into my bunk. And basically, you know, in a company, in a tank company, there's only three officers, right? There are three platoons. So you're very close with the officers in your company. There's a company commander, a deputy company commander, and three platoon commanders. That's it. Five of you. And there's only three of you in the room because the company commander and deputy company commander, they have their own room, right? So I walk into this room all excited that I'm finally going to be a certain caliber of guy. How shall I describe this? This room was basically a testimony to the female anatomy. From bottom to top, ceiling, across, everywhere. There was like nowhere in this room that I could look. I walked into this room, and I didn't know what to do with myself. It took me about 3 months to get one of my fellow officers to kind of gradually, you know, because you're like a religious guy, but you come into this, you know, you want to right away start telling them to take down their posters, but, you know, it was going to be kind of silly to wake up early in the morning and do my, you know, say my Modeani in front of, like, you know, Kathy, whoever, right? So I finally got them to start taking down these posters. I still remember there was one poster that Chaim just couldn't, this is a different Chaim, he couldn't let go. And we would have this running debate. And I would say, look, you know, I feel more comfortable, you know, why don't you take it down? And he would say to me, Cindy has been with me for everything. She came with me to Lebanon. She is here now. So we finally reached this compromise, and he posted Cindy on the inside of his locker door. And I would walk in, and I would close the locker, and he would walk in, and he would open the locker. And it was like this running thing, right? So that's just to give you an idea of the environment of the base, which always comes from the top down, so from the leadership down. So this guy, Chaim Barrow, the first morning I was in the army, we were all supposed to go to the tanks, right? And we were supposed to service the tanks. Everybody's supposed to come down and get to work or whatever. And I see that one of the tank crews is missing a couple guys. So I go back up to the, you know, barracks to see where they are, and there's Chaim Barrow, and he's lying in bed, and he's snoring, right? And I'm trying to wake him up. I go down, I come up, I go down, I come up. At one point, he rolls over, and he grabs my shirt, and he goes, "Uftwa!" Right? And he goes back to sleep. So this is my first challenge as an officer. Now, I didn't know this. All right, I only found this out later that afternoon. But there's such a thing in the army called Zman Dafuk. Okay, Zman Dafuk means if you're in the army and you break the law or you do something, you steal whatever, and they catch you and they send you to military prison. The time that you serve in military prison does not come off your army service for obvious reasons, right? Because then guys who didn't want to do the army would just do a little fun and go sit in prison all day, right? So he had done 3 months in military prison. And therefore, he was really supposed to be finished the army. He was in the middle of his Zman Dafuk. He had like 6 weeks left of the army. But really, he was supposed to be done already. So he was very veteran. He'd been in the army much longer than I had been in the army. I only found out later that the reason he had gone to military prison was for decking an officer. So that made it interesting, right? But anyway, Chaim Barrow had a ritual, okay? Every night, all the guys who were free, they would all gather in his room. And they would make coffee, and they would make chips, you know, like potato, french fries, whatever, and oil, right? And they would have a ceremony. He had this big chart on his wall, okay? And the chart was the number of days that were left until he got out of the army, all right? And every night he would have a big ritual. He would put a kippah on, and he would X, you know, another X, and he would make a blessing. He would say, Hayom, yom, esrim v'arba, od shlosha shavuot v'shlosha yamim, ad shehayim bero yotze migeinom. You know, today there are 3 weeks and 4 days left until Chaim Barrow gets out of hell. That was like his thing, right? And that makes a lot of sense. And then the next night there would be 22 days left, and the next night there would be 21 days left, and that makes sense. You count down. But we don't do that. We count up. Why are we counting up? If you're counting up, what that means is that what's really important is the beginning. And by the way, what do we call this? We call this the counting of the Omer. But the Omer was something we offered on the first day that we're done with. It's barley bread. It's animal food. So why do I call this the counting of the Omer? Makes no sense. Here's another question. Okay? I can think of a good reason why we offer up barley grain. It's because this is really the second day of Pesach. Now what can I not eat on Pesach? Chametz, right? If wheat gets mixed with water, right, and I make dough and the dough rises, right, then I can't eat it. So maybe for some reason it's easier to have barley, because maybe somehow the barley won't become chametz. I have not been able to find any source for this whatsoever, and in fact, I don't personally think this is true, but it could be. Okay? But even if that was true, what's really strange about this is, whereas on Pesach, okay, on Passover, this is something we're going to get to later, whereas on Pesach, on Passover, right, I am not supposed to eat chametz, I'm not supposed to eat leavened bread, right, where the yeast, the dough has risen. On Shavuot, which is the festival that occurs 7 weeks after Pesach, right, what are the rituals of Shavuot? This is interesting. Okay, on Pesach you have matzah, you have maror, you have charoset, you have the 4 cups of wine, you have the Seder, you have children asking questions, there's so much going on. Sukkot, oh my gosh, you have the booth, the sukkah, you have the lulav and the etrog, the lemon type fruit, right? All sorts of stuff. What are the rituals of Shavuot? What do you have on Shavuot? Nothing. You got nothing. Cheesecake. Yeah, but that's not in the Torah. That's just somebody gets smart. There was a woman who was married to a great rabbi, and she got up in the morning and she had a prophetic vision. If we will find a reason to eat milk, I will not have to cook meat, right? I mean, there is a basis, and we'll get to that if you want to remind me at the end. There is a basis for this. It's because Sisra and Yael and dairy, and we won't go there right now. But on Shavuot, there is one symbol. We don't have it anymore because we don't have a temple, but we'll have it again, and that is the central sacrifice of Shavuot. Do you know what the central sacrifice of Shavuot is? It's called the Shtei Halechem. It's actually on this page. The very next topic in the Torah, I don't know if I photostated it. You take 2 whole loaves of bread, and you put them together, and you offer them up to God. And you have some more waving fun. Now this is very interesting. Think about this. On Pesach, I'm not allowed to eat chametz. As a matter of fact, right, everybody here knows what chametz is? Yes? Okay, right? Not allowed to eat chametz on Pesach. As a matter of fact, chametz has come to personify the sum totality, the essence of evil. And Maimonides calls it, you know, the swelling of the chametz is like the swelling of the ego, right? The swelling of the sexual organ, desire, right? I'm supposed to become humble. The Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. The Talmud says that, you know, what's the real cause of sin, right? the yeast in the dough. This is evil. And I'm supposed to get it out of my house. And in fact, if you eat chametz on Passover, right, the consequence of eating chametz on Passover is one of the most severe consequences we have in Judaism. It's called karet, kares, some sort of excision of your soul from the Jewish people. And yet 7 weeks later, we can't wait, we get to Shavuot, and what do? We're right back to chametz. And not only that, but the chametz becomes the sacrifice. I mean, didn't this ever bother you? I remember, I've for a few years now, I go to America for Pesach. We were on Shlichut, we were living in America for a few years, and developed a relationship with this family. They put together these tours, and the first year of Pesach in America, you know, my daughter had been very sick, and we had a whole story, we didn't really know people yet. So I got asked to come and teach in this hotel for Pesach. So I thought about this, you know, because I happen to think it's very special to be at home for Pesach, but then I thought, I'm in a strange place, I don't really know anybody yet. You know, my daughter just got out of the hospital. 5-star hotel, the wife doesn't have to cook, or, honey, how many guests can we have? Not a difficult decision. I was deep in the good book for, you know, a month, a year, every year for the last few years, right? So rent this hotel. This is a whole different experience. Whole different experience. I have never seen so much food in my life. Ever. In fact, I remember at the last day of the festival, it was a Shabbat, the first year we were there, and so they have third meal on Shabbat afternoon. They have like a meat third meal with like hot pastrami and everything. Unbelievable. Right? And people get up, they can't move. They can't, they like roll over. But the only exercise that they get is that they walk over to the table with the food because it's a mitzvah, right? And they just take these mounding piles. And I see on the schedule the night after the festival is over that they have this barbecue. And I said to the guy who runs this, I said, you gotta be kidding me. I said, you gonna have a barbecue? Aren't people stuffed? He started laughing. He said, oh, you'll see. You'll see. Right? And this is like 2 hours after they have this meat shalashidis. Sure enough, Pesach is over and we're packing up, we're going out. Right? But all these people stay a couple more days. And I'm walking out of the hotel and I see there's like this big barbecue, you know? I said, you know, I'll grab a hot dog for the road. They were all gone. They're finished. They piled over. It's unbelievable. Right? It's like something out of a wide world. Right? We get so, doesn't it bother you? Like you spend this whole week getting rid of chametz and all the rabbis talk about the evil of chametz. And then as soon as Pesach's over, evil of chametz, can you pass the pizza please? Like what is that? Why am I making yesterday's nemesis tomorrow's hero? What's the point here? So, let me share with you an idea. Any questions that I missed? Yes?
Something right before it says, the first day of rest.
Oh, from the end of Pesach, right. Right. You know, if we would have started counting after Pesach is really over, after the 7 days of Pesach, right? Then in fact, you're right, then we would have had 6 weeks of counting until Shavuot, right? So the truth is, one thing is clear, the word Shabbat here, I mean, Macharata Shabbat, from the day after Shabbat, seems to imply a day, a specific day that is known as Shabbat. Okay? So it's the first day, it's the last day, it's whatever day, it's definitely a day. That seems to imply. So why do you arrive at the conclusion that it's the day after Shabbat? I'll tell you an interesting thing. And this is where I think that Tzedukim didn't understand something very critical about Judaism. Right? And this is worth a 5-minute divergence, because this is probably one of the most essential issues in studying Torah, by far. You know, at the end of the day, what do you do with this book? Okay? There are two possibilities for this book. Okay? This book is either a divine book, you know, something that comes from God, or it's a written book. Now, it might have been written by a brilliant bunch of individuals, okay? But if human beings wrote it, it's a book written by human beings. And most people struggle with this question. Well, so how do I know? Now, this is a very important question. I mean, this changes everything. I mean, if this book is written by God, that's a whole different equation. If this book is written by human beings, to be honest, as much as I might think they were brilliant human beings, as much as I think that they gave us a gift which saw us through a long time, I'm not so sure if people who sat and wrote 2,000, 3,000 years ago really know what's going on in the world today, and therefore maybe it's not relevant anymore. You know, I don't know, take for example constitutional law. So there are whole discussions, you know, about what it means in the Constitution. You know, it says in the Constitution we have the right to bear arms in America, right? Well, what does that mean? Do we always have the right to bear arms? Do we only have the right to bear arms if there's danger? What about if those arms are dangerous to the rest of society? There's this whole discussion about what the original formers of the Constitution meant when they said we have the right to bear arms. But nobody stands up and says, well, wait a second, what if they were wrong? What if everybody shouldn't have the right to bear arms? What if there's like, you know, the 28th Amendment? And if thou doth have crack in your brain, thou shalt not have the right to bear arms. You know, whatever it might be. Now, if human beings write something, human beings can be wrong. That's the nature of the human being. The human being is not objective, he's subjective. But if God writes something, then that's the definition of right. And this doesn't prove anything about God or belief or atheism, because, you know, this is one of the basic, the most essential questions in terms of belief. One of the difficult problems for atheism is how one comes up with an objective system of right and wrong, if in fact there is no God. Right? And that doesn't prove the atheist wrong. The atheist might be willing to say, so there is no objective right or wrong. That's okay. Most atheists don't want to say that. To believe that the only, you know, Bertrand Russell wrote, to believe that the only thing wrong with cruelty is that I don't like it, that's absurd. That was his opinion. And he struggled with this as a self-declared atheist. And by the way, it doesn't prove that God exists, because maybe I made up God just to solve this problem. This proves nothing. Right? But most people are uncomfortable dealing with the idea that something is wrong just because I don't like it. Right? There is no such thing as an objectively wrong thing. You can't explain why something is wrong unless there's a creator of all wrong and right. Some people will say that something is wrong because society decides it's wrong, right? Well, what if society decides that what's wrong is right and what's right is wrong? That's what happened in Nazi Germany. What if the world gets together? There were periods of our existence where you could make a case for saying the majority of the world felt that it was okay to crucify and murder Jews. That didn't make it right. But why wasn't it right? Okay? So if there's going to be an objective right or objective wrong, there has to be a God. But that doesn't prove anything. How do I know? And I want you to know, I struggled with this question for a long time. For a long time. You know, when I was in high school, I told you I went to Yeshiva High School, started struggling with, okay, so is this real or is this Memorex, right? I mean, if this whole thing is a mistake, why on earth am I getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to Minyan every day, right? To pray and everything else. So I struggled with these questions, and whatever, that's a whole discussion in and of itself. But this is one of the things I struggled with. And when I left high school and I went to Yeshiva, I wanted to see if I could figure out the answer to this. Now, when I first approached this question, I approached it the way I was, you know, brought up to approach such questions, from a, you know, logical, rational, rhetorical perspective, you know, cerebral. So I started reading everything I get my hands on whether the Torah is divine. You know, and I read all the books, you know, Permission to Believe and Permission to Receive and the 9 questions people ask about Judaism and the Rambam and the Mordechai. And I'll be honest with you, I could give you a course on all the rational explanations for why this is a divine book. And I could give you a course on the rational explanations for why it isn't a divine book. And I can tell you that from my perspective, logically, it makes a lot of sense to me that it's a divine book, but that did nothing for me. Just because I could explain rationally why something seemed to be correct did nothing for me. It didn't change my relationship with this book one iota, and it didn't get me anywhere. So one day, I just decided to let it go. I figured instead of trying to decide, instead of trying to prove, why don't I just try to experience? So I decided, I don't need to know right now that this is a divine book, but since there are a lot of people who think it's a divine book, and since they seem to have a pretty happy way of living, I just started to read this book as though it were a divine book, just to see what that would do for my study. Right? And basically what I was doing was I was going on a date. I was going on a date with Torah, you know? And dating is an interesting thing. You know, if you meet a girl, and you're going out on a date, and, you know, you go out for coffee, and you sit down, and, you know, she orders the caramel macchiato, and you order the vanilla latte, and you sit down at your table, and you say to her, so, you think we should get married? So she looks at you like you're nuts, right? And you're not going to get any far, right? You got to just go on a date. And people say, well, what should you look for on a date? And I know there's this whole perspective in Shidduchim. You know, marriage, by the way, for those of you that are still looking, is not such a complex process. It really isn't. Right? You got to find someone that you trust and that you respect. You got to find someone with who you share the same values. You have to have some attraction to them. Right? And you have to both be prepared to work at making the marriage work. That's it. If you find someone who's really willing to work and you find you're somewhat attracted to him, you don't have to be Hollywood romance, you don't have to hear the music, that's a whole other discussion, and you respect them, you trust them, marry them, and you'll see. You'll make an incredible marriage. This is not so complicated. Right? But how do you get there? So you go on a date. You're having a good time on the date. Go on another date. You have a good time on that date. Go on another date. And you know what? One day, if you do this enough, you'll wake up and you'll realize you found the right person. And people get so stuck, so how do you know? I have no idea how you know. I really don't. I know that I knew. I know now, looking back, that I really had no idea. I just thought I knew. In fact, at the risk of extreme repetition to some of the people in this room, I even know exactly the moment that I knew, because I met Dorit on a Thursday afternoon, and we're sitting Tuesday night. This is like 5 days later. Well, we met once before for about 40 minutes, but whatever. But we're sitting about 5 days later. It's Tuesday night. We're sitting in Kibbutz Kfar Etzion, and we're talking, and I was completely swept off my feet. And she looks at me, and she says, I want you to know that I know we're going to get married. Right? She says. And then she says, and I want you to know that you know we're going to get married. She says, when you know that you know, let me know. And I didn't run, and that's how I knew. And I look back now, and I had no idea. It was ridiculous that I thought I knew. I had no idea. So I went on a date. You go on a date, you have a good time, go on another date. You have a good time, go on another date. You have a good time, go on another date. One day, you'll realize this is ridiculous. You should get married. So, go on a date. I went on a date with Shabbat. And I went on a date with Torah. And I started dating, and one day I just figured it out. You know? I let go of all the questions. So my advice, first of all, if you want to know how to deal with this question, it's just my personal opinion. Stop struggling with what this is. Just go on a date. Read this book as though it's divine. And by the way, just for the record, I get very nervous when people walk into a room or a seminar or a 3-hour lecture and they walk out saying, I know the Torah is divine. I think that's a lifetime struggle, and it's a good struggle, and there's a lot of work to it, and we can have long discussions about it. You know, that's a serious, serious statement. And it takes a lot of work to get there, and it's worthwhile work. Let go of the question. Go on a date. You have a good time. Go on another date. Maybe one day, you know, I can only say for myself, and again, I remind you of our discussion yesterday, totally not my issue whether you accept this or not. I'm telling you this because we're about to have a discussion. You need to know where I'm coming from. Right? You need to know what I think. That's all. Otherwise, we can't communicate. I have no agenda to get you to agree with this. This is either true or it's not true, and whether you think it or not is really not going to affect whether it's true. It might change the way you look at the world, and if it was me, I would be interested because I think it's made my life worthwhile, but that's up to you. I think that there are people in this world who desperately wish that they could accept that this book was divine, but they have to be honest with themselves, and I respect that a lot. You have to know who you are, right? But for me, after a while, I started dating this book, and I started learning more and more. One day, I woke up and I said, you know what, there's just no way that human beings could have written this book. It just doesn't work for me. And so I came to the conclusion, this is a divine book, which brings me to the second point and back to our discussion. Okay, see, you need to know that for me, this book is a divine book, right? That this comes from Hashem. And how that works is an interesting question. What does that really mean? You see, love and relationships, one of the key components of love and relationships is trust, right? Trust, okay? If you find the greatest guy, and he's everything you're looking for, and you think he's the Marlboro Man, right? He's Batman, he's Superman, he's unbelievable. And maybe you're attracted to him, and maybe he does great things, but you don't respect him, you don't trust him, you can't marry him. In fact, you're going to have a difficult time having a relationship with him. You know? I mean, you have to be able to trust and respect. Like, Baruch Hashem, I have no secrets from my wife. I know some people do that sort of thing. It's just not worth it. I don't go there. There isn't anything about me that my wife doesn't know. Anything. You know? The good, the bad, the ugly, the whole geschäft, she knows it all. Right? And I know it all about her. At least I think I know it all about her. Right? And what you get out of that is this enormous sense of trust. Now, I'll give you an example, okay? If I walk into this room, you have to remind me your name?
Ben.
Ben, okay? I walk into this room, it's a good Ben. Ben, I like that, okay? If I walk into this room, okay, and Ben looks at me and says, listen, I need you to hop. I look at Ben and say, okay, we got another one, right? You know? I said, look, you know, I'm going to have to teach a class. I said, no, hop. So, I don't know if I would hop. Or maybe I'd be nice and I'd take a couple hops, but, you know, after a while, I mean, you know, I'm done with hopping. But if my wife was sitting there, and I walked in the room, and my wife said, listen, I need you to hop, I'd be hopping. I'd be hopping till I fell over. In fact, I remember once I was on a trip to America. Okay? It's a great example, because this was an epiphany for me. It was an altering experience. I was on a trip to America, and I came back from the airport, and I always call from the airport to let my family know I'm coming. And I get to the front door and I knock on the door, right? There's halacha, you're supposed to knock on the door, even your own house. You give people the respect, you're giving them a moment to know you're coming in. And I actually love that moment. I love that moment at the door. It's wrapped up with my relationship with Mezuzah. You know, the sounds when you walk into your space, your home, are always wonderful sounds, right? Especially like I travel a lot, I come home and I can hear the little footsteps. You know, Yair is usually the first. He's coming from somewhere across the house. Right? And then like, you know, Adi is like, Abba, you know. You get to like Yonatan, it's like, Abba, right? And then my aunt, you know, she's the teenager. Hey, Abba's home. You know, right? Boo, right? And I hear all these noises, and I'm getting ready to go in, and all of a sudden I hear from the kitchen or somewhere, you know, don't come in! That's my wife. Okay, I've been away for 10 days. I'm tired. I'm verschwitzt. I just want to come in, see the kids. Don't come in. Now, maybe in the movies, you know, there'd be music and the guy outside the door would start to get suspicious. Well, I'm not having any of those thoughts. If my wife tells me not to come in, I'm not coming in, right? And if she tells me to come back tomorrow, I'm coming back tomorrow. That's just the way it works, right? In fact, I've learned over a number of years of marriage that whenever I listen to my wife, it always works. And whenever I don't, it always doesn't. It's just uncanny. So I've let go of this issue, right? Listen to this well, okay? It's a very serious statement there, you'll see, if you're smart, right? So I'm waiting outside, I hear all these funny noises and whatever stuff going on, and then eventually, you know, one of the kids opens the door, and I come in, and my aunt gives me a hug, and Yonta gives me a hug, it's a little weird. I thought maybe there was like a party, you know, they're putting up posters or something. No posters, no cards, no presents, you know. We have a deal I have with my kids, you know, I used to bring them lots of presents, and then after a while I started realizing how unhealthy that was. You know, and I even remember when I realized this, because I would come home, you know, like Santa Claus, because I'd feel so bad, you know, all these presents, right? Santa Claus, Hanukkah Chaim, right? And once I went on a trip, and a week later it was Hanukkah, and I remember we were at my parents' house, and my parents were giving the grandkids presents, and my mother got a sweater for one of the kids, and this particular child turned to me and said, and like my heart sank. I was like, okay, that's it. We're done with presents, right? Next time I went to America, I told my children before I left, I said, no more presents. I'm the present. I come home, I'm the present. That's your present. And you know what? They were great about it. They never needed the presents. They never complained about it. Kids don't need all that stuff. But anyway, so I thought I would see there's nothing. Turned out what happened. Adi had gotten so excited about coming to the door and seeing Abba that she had, you know, thrown up, right? So now there's a pile of vomit in front of the door. My wife didn't want me to walk in and slide through a pile of vomit. So she's cleaning everything up, you know, before I come in. Now, I got to be honest with you. If I was home for 10 days with four kids and my wife went off on a trip and she came back at the end of 10 days and one of the kids vomited, I'd be like, there you go. You know, that'd be it. So I gained such an appreciation, you know, for who this person is and how much I mean to her, and our relationship, like, took a huge leap. Like, that she's willing to clean up vomit after 10 days. That's unbelievable, right? Trust is the essential piece of a relationship. This is very important. You see, if 4, 5, 6 different brilliant individuals, A and B and J and whatever, they wrote this book, then this might have been a brilliant book 3,000 years ago. But what the heck do they know about my life and dealing with the internet? But if this is written by Hashem, and if I believe, which I do, that Hashem created me, so I just can't imagine that Hashem would ever do anything to want to torture me. It makes no sense. Everything in here must be magnificent. I just got to figure it out. And that's true with everything. Okay? Number one. Number two, when you look at this book, and this is now what I'm going to tell you, the reason we got into this whole discussion. This book, I want you to know, is written. This is our written tradition. 5 books of Moses, written tradition. This book makes absolutely no sense on its own. None whatsoever. Okay? It doesn't make sense. I'll give you an example. Tefillin. Anybody who knows what tefillin is, right? Okay? There's only 2 verses in the whole Torah repeated about tefillin. Right? It says, Ukshatam le'ot al yadecha, ve'il katavar b'nenecha. They'll be tied for a sign, right, on your hand. And they'll be like, totafot, let's call that an adornment between your eyes. That's what it says. So imagine that I'm all excited and I just discovered this whole new Jewish thing, right? And I'm going back to, I'm going back to America, but I want to try this out. So I figure, you know, I'm going to go down to the Kotel, to the wall, and check out the tefillin thing. It's a little weird, you know, guys waking up in the morning, binding themselves in leather, but okay, right? So I go down to the Kotel, right? And I did my research. Only 2 verses. I looked this up in the book. Tells me what to do. So I put on my tefillin. I put the first one over here, because it says, "Ukshatam le'ot al yadecha," you shall tie them on your hand. Right? And then I put the next one over here, right? Because it's supposed to be beninecha, between your eyes. And I walk down to the Kotel and I'm so excited. And somebody, hopefully, politely comes over to me and says, I think you want to move that up there, and this really goes over here. And I said, no, I read the book. I read the manual, right? And the most amazing thing is, anywhere you go in the world, people do the same thing. They put it up here. They don't put it over here. In fact, it's interesting. It doesn't tell me anywhere in the Torah what color tefillin are. But anywhere in the world you will go, they all wear the same black tefillin. In fact, I've been waiting for years for some Israelite student to come in and say, you know, black, ooh, so heavy. Let's make some, like, psychedelic tefillin, you know, that'll be cool. Boxes, ooh, right? One of the reasons that the majority rabbinic opinion was that Ethiopian Jews came from the Lost Tribes was because they have the exact same tefillin that we do. And they've been separated from us for over 2,000 years. Anywhere in the Jewish world you go, there's a verse in the Torah that says, "Ulukachtem lachem mipri etz hadar." You're supposed to take for yourselves from the fruit of a beautiful tree. On Sukkot, on the festival of Sukkot. What's the fruit of a beautiful tree? So we have a tradition. It's an etrog. But it doesn't say that anywhere in the Torah. And yet, anywhere in the world you go, now granted, the Yemenites have bigger etrog, because there's always some Jewish community that wants to do it bigger and better, right? But it's still an etrog. You won't find anybody with peaches. But it doesn't say anywhere in this book what kind of fruit it is. And there are endless examples of this. Ritual slaughter. It's clear from the Torah there's a special system of ritual slaughter, but it doesn't tell me what it is. And everybody does the same thing. They cut the kanan neveshet. So it cannot be that every Jew everywhere in the world has the same tradition, okay, which is an oral tradition, and that they all do the same thing unless this was given with an oral tradition. The source of this, the oral tradition, has to come at the same time as the written tradition. Otherwise, it's pretty improbable that everybody would have the same customs. So that means that if you buy into the fact that this tradition comes from one source, I'm putting aside, by the way, for the moment, the fact that the Jews have been the most scattered people in history, and yet they all kept these same customs, right? And that if this was written as a non-divine book, that would present tremendous challenges. But putting that aside for the moment, what that means is that not only is the written tradition divine, but so is the oral tradition. Because the oral tradition and the written tradition go hand in hand. One makes no sense without the other. And that brings us back to this question. If you want to know, if you want to talk logically about the verse, Mimacharata Shabbat, that you count the Omer from the day after Shabbat, we can talk about the logics of it and whether it works and whether it doesn't work. But it really depends where you're starting from. It's hard for me with that question because my starting point is a different starting point. It's like if we walk into the house and you say to me, you know, it's not logical for you to be waiting outside the door. I'd look at you like you just don't get it. This has nothing to do with logic. That's my wife talking. I'm outside the door, right? So if I listen to my wife, wouldn't I listen to my life? I mean, right? So that's a whole different way of looking at the world. You know, I don't put on tefillin in the morning because I get it and I understand it and it's meaningful. It happens to be that there are some incredibly beautiful messages about tefillin. And the symbols that tefillin conjure for me personally when I put them on in the morning are very powerful. The idea that I wrap it around my finger, that I say verastichli, and that it's a betrothal, and what the difference is between getting engaged to God and getting married to God. There's a whole thought process you go through. But if I didn't get it at all, or if I find out tomorrow that everything I understood is completely wrong, I would still put on tefillin because of where I believe that comes from. So having said that, my question is not, well, wait a second, maybe it means. That's not my question. That might be yours, and it's a good question if it's your question. I just want you to understand why it's not my question. My question is, why does the Torah, like, Hashem wants me to get this mitzvah as the day after Shabbat? That's very strange. Do you hear that that's strange? That's just not the way I would have expected this mitzvah to be presented. To count, to offer the Omer from the day after Shabbat, when it really means the day after Pesach. So what does that mean? So somehow the Pesach is associated with Shabbat, and you see this mentioned in a couple of places. In fact, in verse 11, it says, "Ve'nifat ha'omer l'tnei Hashem l'tzorchem b'macharat ha'Shabbat." He waves it on the day after Shabbat, right? And if you look in verse 15, "Usfartem lachem b'macharat ha'Shabbat," and you shall count it on the day after Shabbat. The Torah is making a point that this is b'macharat ha'Shabbat, the day after Shabbat. So what is that? So in order to understand that, I have to understand what Shabbat is. If I don't understand what Shabbat is, I'm not going to understand what the day after Shabbat means. So now I want to tell you something deep. And this will help us understand this whole concept of Omer and what it is that I'm trying to count in the Omer. Alright? What is the Omer? So I'll tell you one way of looking at the Omer. You know, there are different experiences in life. Sometimes you have experiences and they're lechem. They're bread. And sometimes you have experiences and they're barley. Now there's two types of bread. There's bread that comes from heaven and there's bread that comes from the earth. Okay? Bread, by the way, is the sum total. I don't think we talked about this yet. Bread is the sum total of everything I accomplish in this world. In fact, the Gemara, the Talmud and Brachot says that there are 10 words in the blessing for bread, right? Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz. 10 words. And that's because there are 10 processes in the making of bread. I come to a field. I have to plow it. I have to sow seeds. I eventually have to reap it and thresh it and winnow it. Right? And I get all the way to the dough, and I make the dough, and then I knead it, and I bake it. It's a long process to make bread. So bread represents the work that I put into this world and the result of the work that I put into this world. But there's two types of bread. There's two types of stuff that comes into our life. There's bread from heaven. Sometimes you get bread from heaven. You know, you get a letter in the mail, you won the sweepstakes. So if you're like me, you throw that right in the trash, because you know nobody wins the sweepstakes. But maybe you're not like me, maybe you're smarter than me, and you actually figure, what do I have to lose, right? And you give them a fake address and a fake number, but you call up and you actually win $1 million. Unbelievable, right? That's bread from heaven. You didn't do anything to earn that, it's bread from heaven. You know? And then there's bread from earth. You know, you work really hard to build something. And you know, I don't know, you have a relationship. And it was so hard to develop that relationship. And you feel like you put so much effort in, and you went for help, and you went for counseling, and you have this incredible relationship. And that's bread from earth. And sometimes you have bread that's just pure heaven. You know, like, I don't know, like being married, like having children. You know, people have this whole issue with, like, the singles. And I was once talking to somebody who said, you know, there's so many singles today. I don't like the word singles, but we'll use it for the purpose of discussion. So many singles today. Oh, the website is full of singles. So many singles today. As if, like, the singles are doing something wrong. Which is just a terrible way to look at the world. And not at all true. Because that would imply that somehow those of us who are married, we did something right. And I don't think that's true. I don't think that there's enough that you could do in this world to merit having met the right person. That just has to be bread from heaven. It just can't be that when I was 25 years old, that I had somehow done so much right that I merited to meet the woman that I'm married to and to have the four children that I have, Baruch Hashem. It's just, that's bread from heaven. But then, even within the world of bread from heaven, there's bread and then there's barley. You know? I remember one time, sitting at the Shabbos table, right? My aunt must have been, I don't know, 2-3 years old. Oh, no, it was Yonathan. Like 2-3 years old. And, you know, it's a beautiful custom. You bless your children, right? Friday night. You know? And there's a Hasidic custom that before you give them the traditional priestly blessing, which is in the Torah, that you take a moment and you say their name by name, and you appreciate who they are, and you thank Hashem for making them a part of your life. And all the dreams that you have for who they could be, and everything they've given you this week, and everything you hope for in the coming week, and forever. And that's like an enormous moment. You know? And I never really thought about this until years later, but you're sitting at a Shabbat table, and in our Shabbat table, very often there's like a whole table full of adults. You know? And everybody just stops. They just stop, and they wait. While I give a blessing to my children, and then my wife gives a blessing to your children, you stop to think what that does for your child. Like your 5-year-old child all of a sudden realizes that the whole world is waiting because she's important. That's just unbelievable, right? So one week I'm giving a bracha to Yonatan, and he looks at me and goes, Abba, can I give you a bracha? Wow. Right? This doesn't get better than that. So I say, sure you can give me a bracha, right? So he puts his hand on my head and goes, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam, Amotzi Lechem Min Haaretz, right? He gives me a bracha, right? That's just sweet challah, right? But then there's sometimes, you know, sometimes there's barley. Now barley could be the little things, I don't know. You just get to the wedding, right? And it's your brother's wedding, and you're all dressed in tuxedos, and everybody's all ready, and you got your beautiful dresses on, right? And little Yonatan just, right? All over the tuxedo. So that's barley, right? That's definitely barley, right? And you know, changing diapers and washing dishes. I remember once we had a woman came to Israelite, and she was a young woman, but she just looked like life had just sucked her dry. And I was giving this class, we were doing the Ten Commandments, we were talking about parenting and children, and we got into this whole discussion. At one point she looks at me and I could sense there was like a lot of pain in her experience. She said, you know, for 35 years, I was married, I have children, and I washed and cleaned and cooked and changed diapers and did carpools, and now I'm saying to myself, where'd my life go? And it was such a painful question. And on the one hand, it brings us back to where we were before, right? Up and down standards. Where did your life go? And you know what? I look back on that question and I realize she didn't understand what she was asking. Because you see, that's the barley of life. That is the barley of life. You can't get rid of that. You know, we have there's this whole industry that developed around, I'm going to get away on vacation. Right? I have to get away. You know what it means if you have to get away to go on vacation? It means life. I'm not interested in life. I just want to get away. But you only get away for 2 weeks a year. That means the rest of the year you're miserable, right? Judaism doesn't believe you have to get away. You have to get into. You know, they say time is money, right? Time is not money. Time is life. Life is time. All this barley of life is the spice of life. You can't get rid of it. It's part of life. The question is, what do you do with it? See, there's a totally different way of looking at the barley of life. And that is that barley itself is the first sacrifice. It's the beginning. It's right after I say to God that I'm willing to take Egypt out of me and begin my journey as part of the Jewish people. God says that very next day, he says, I want you to give me some barley. I want you to know that the barley in life is the beginning of your greatest offering to me. You know, my kids were little. I actually used to enjoy changing their diapers. It didn't bother me at all. My wife made a joke of it. She would like send me to change diapers. I just, you know, you get a little kid and he's 6 months old. And you put him on the changing table, and he's as pure can be, you know? And you know, you get the wipe thing going, whatever it is, but that's such a bonding moment with your children. That's such an unbelievable gift. And I was conscious of the fact that before I know it, I'm not going to get to do that again. Like, you know, I'm not changing diapers anymore, Baruch Hashem. And you know, right. And we're like at a whole different stage. And I don't, you know, I'm not melancholy about it. I'm happy with what I have now. But in a way, like, you miss that. That's an enormous thing. A little child that's totally dependent on you. Right? That barley is as much a part of the gift of life as walking your daughter down to the wedding. That's just the barley of life. And the question is, do you offer up that barley? Do you realize the joy in that barley? That every given moment is an offering of barley. You know? And that's why we call this the counting of the Omer. Because we're not really trying to count just to get someplace. We're also counting in order to be someplace. And that brings me to Shabbat, and this will end, right? What does it mean that the Omer is Mimacharat HaShabbat, the day after Shabbat? What is Shabbat? So Shabbat's a very interesting experience. What do I do on Shabbat? 6 days a week we work, and we work hard. And it's good that we work hard. And the verse says, Shesh Yishtemim Tavodu Vasita Kol Melachtecha. 6 days you shall work and do all your labor. The seventh day, that's for Hashem. So most people understand that to mean 6 days you can do whatever you want. Right? You can work. You can do all your labor. Do whatever you want. But on the seventh day, you don't do any labor. But that's not how Judaism looks at that verse. Judaism says, 6 days, I want you to be my partner in creating a world. I want you to be my partner. I want you to build and create and bring majesty into the world. But on the seventh day you slow down so that you have a chance to ask yourself what it is you're doing all week and why you're doing it. We get so caught up in the journey, we don't even think about where we're going. Never mind where we are. So the seventh day is the day of learning to be in the moment. To actually be in the moment. You know, we live in a society that is almost incapable. I remember once I had a meeting with a very successful individual. Somebody wanted me to get, my brother-in-law was, you know, close with this guy, really wanted me to meet this guy. And he was like a big president of a big company. And I don't run after this. He said, okay, you know, maybe the helpers were like, great. So I said, fine. So, you know, till we worked it out, he couldn't make this time, he couldn't make that time. We finally found, you know, a meeting time, he had 15 minutes. Right? He has 15 minutes. He's in between this and that. 15 minutes, okay. I'll be honest with you, I don't know what you could do with a 15-minute meeting. But if Hashem worked it out, then I'm supposed to sit with this guy for 15 minutes. Something's going to come out of this meeting, right? I don't know. So I come in 15 minutes. He says, what can I do for you? I said, nothing. What can I do for you? I don't know. So he said, well, nothing. So I said, okay, so let's learn. I don't know. Whatever will come out of it, right? So I figured it was just the two of us in the room, but I was wrong. There was me. There was him. There was his email, which had these funny IM sounds, you know, Yahoo, whatever it was, right? And then there's his cell phone, and his pager, and his phone, and his secretary. There was like a minion in the room. And every time I started to say a sentence, something, oh, hang on a second, hang on. And finally, I said to him, you know what, don't give me 15 minutes. Give me 3 minutes. But just give me 3 minutes. Like, let's just be the two of us. He couldn't do it. He mamish couldn't do it. And I have no chas v'shalom enmity. Like, he's an important man, an important company, and you have to want to do it in order to do it. And you see this all the time in life. I remember once that we had a student, and he called me up on Friday afternoon. He was visiting Israel. And I always tell my students, you know, if you're ever back and you're free, come for Shabbos, whatever it is. So he calls me up on a Friday, and he says, listen, I'm back in the country, and I told you if I'm ever back, I would come. I said, yeah, for sure, come for Shabbat. We have a whole crew over. So he said, well, the only problem is I have to be in Tel Aviv tonight. So I would love to come to you tomorrow for Shabbat lunch, but I have to drive to you. Is that okay? You know, it's an honest question, right? So Rav Kook has a whole discussion about this. I said to him, listen, if you're going to stay at home, better you stay at home and don't drive to me. But if you're going to drive anyway, and you're going to drive to the golf course, drive to me instead of the golf course and have Shabbos lunch, right? And that's a, don't walk away with halachic dispensation, but that's my psak. I think that's the way to do it. Fine. So he comes to me for lunch. So I'm sitting at lunch. Now the phone never rings in my house because people know that I'm not going to pick it up. For some reason, this Shabbos, the phone rang. Every once in a while, you know, student overseas gets it wrong, or it's a wrong number, whatever it is. The phone starts to ring. I was in the middle of this amazing, I still remember what it was about, this amazing discussion with Mayan, who was then 5 years old. We're just getting into this deep discussion. If you haven't met Mayan, that may sound funny, but if you have, you know what I mean. So we just get into this really deep discussion, right? And the phone's ringing. And I'm not paying attention to the phone because it's Shabbat. Anybody who really needs to reach me knows how to reach me. But this guy is sitting at the table, right? And he's like listening to our conversation. He's looking at the phone. Listening to our conversation, looking at the phone. Finally says, you're not going to get that. I said, no, Shabbos, it's okay, right? And I go back to the discussion, a couple more rings. He says, you know, I don't mind getting it for you, right? I said, no, it's okay, Shabbos, I don't want you to get it, it's fine, right? And for some reason, it's still ringing. A couple more rings go on, and finally he says to me, I really don't mind getting it for you. Now this guy knows that this phone call's not for him, right? He's just gotten to a point in his life where he can't sit next to a ringing phone. You see, one day a week, I get to decide that the phone doesn't rule me. I rule the phone. You can really be in the moment. You bring me a room full of people at the end of Shabbat, religious Jews, whatever that means, who don't light fire on Shabbat. And you stand around a table, and we'll light up a Havdalah candle, and I'll get the guitar out, and I'll tell you who the smokers are. Because they're the ones going like this. They didn't smoke all Shabbos. So everybody else is in Havdalah, they're not. They're already somewhere else. Can you learn to be in the moment? That's the essence of Shabbat. And we can sit here and talk about this till we're blue in the face, but when you sit here on Friday afternoon, and you leave your cell phones wherever you're staying, and you just sit here, and you're in the moment, and there's nowhere to run to. It's just to be in time. You know, it's like what Aaron likes to say, nobody dances to get to the last step, right? If you were at a Jewish wedding, and they're all dancing in a circle, and somebody said, when are we going to get there? You'd think he was an idiot. Because the whole point of that dance is just to be in the moment together, right? That's Shabbat. So think about it. Mimacharat Shabbat, the day after Shabbat, the day after, that's true, Pesach is also Shabbat, and Pesach I also learned to be in the moment. The day after this, this energy, this experience of Shabbat, of being in the moment, is what gives me the ability to offer up my barley. Because if I could really learn to be in the moment, then I wouldn't be thinking, why am I changing my kid's diaper when I gotta catch up on email? The email wouldn't bother me, because right now I'm with my child. And if I was on email, I wouldn't be worrying, why am I not helping my child? Because right now I'm on email. Wherever you are, to be in that moment. Being in a moment is a decision process. It's an absolute decision that where I am now and what I am now is where I'm meant to be. And that's very deep. That changes the way you live life. And that's why we count up, and that's why we count the Omer. And that's why we wave this. Because this is about what's around me in the world. It's about bringing the world into my life and bringing Hashem into the world. And if we could just learn to do this, this would change the nature of life itself. So as the Jewish people are marching towards Shavuot and getting ready to receive the Torah, which is tomorrow morning's discussion, as they're getting ready to bring Torah into their life, Hashem says to them, you know, Torah, this is going to be huge. This is going to be the most monumental experience the Jewish people have ever had. They're going to somehow see sound. They're going to talk to God. They're going to see fire and lightning and receive Torah. And everything else that's going to happen. But in that process, they're going to learn to appreciate the barley of life. And I want you to know, we'll finish with this, just this is your greatest challenge. You know, you're in the midst of Lechem. You're in the midst of Sinai. You're in the old city of Yerushalayim. You know, you've decided to take a week off to experience the joy of life, to be in the moment. And then you're going to get back to wherever it is you come from, because that's what real life is. And you're going to get all back to the barley. The real taste of this experience will be if you can elevate that barley, if you make that barley an offering, you know? If you get off the plane and they lost your luggage, and that's okay, because you're blessed to be healthy and to have luggage to have lost. That's being in the moment. And good luck, right? Okay, anyway, we got to stop.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.